And now, after years of planning, sweating, and going broke, here is the Boots and Whiskey Podcast with Jim Belisle.
And it left the media.
Why they would give this man a podcast is anyone's guess.
And there is what could only be a bizarre coincidence or something else.
Welcome to the Boots and Whiskey Podcast with Jim Belisle.
Trapped, drunk, and stupid is no way to go through life, sir.
Country music and fine moonshine. Finally, a podcast that lets it all hang out.
Let's level with America.
Got your boots? Ready for some whiskey?
These boots are made for walking.
One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
And now, the Boots and Whiskey Podcast with Jim Belisle.
Hey everyone, Jim here, Boots and Whiskey Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We have an episode that I have waited, oh man, a decade plus. And I've only been doing the show 3 years. Today we have Scott Terry on the show, who is the frontman for the Ohio-based band Red Wanting Blue. They're not country. They are not a country band by really any stretch of the imagination, I don't think, minus some great storytelling, some great lyrics, overall great band. I had said it in a post late last week that, you know, they always say don't meet your heroes, right? Because you'll be disappointed or whatever. But Scott has been a musical hero of mine for, 15 years now, easily. And he did not disappoint. There are a lot of technical things in this episode. There are a lot of fun things in this episode. For me, this whole thing was just so incredible and so enthralling that I, you know, me personally, on a personal level, this is one of, if not my favorite conversation I've had to date. And again, it's only because of how much regard I've had for Scott in the last, decade plus. So again, thank you to Scott for coming on the show. I'm like speechless. That's how excited for this episode I am. So I'm going to just shut the fuck up and I'm going to let you enjoy. So thank you for being here. If it's your first time here, welcome. I know we're going to have guests or people here that are listening that don't like country music or have never heard of country music. So I want to thank you for coming. Feel free to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, the whole nine yards. We post things on all the socials at Boots and Whiskey Podcast. Boots and Whiskey Entertainment.com is the website. Big hello to you rock boaters, because I'm sure you're here. So thank you for that. And kick back, relax, enjoy the show, guys. And we'll see you on the flip side. Thanks for being here. Cheers. We want to give a big thank you to our friends over at Off the Rails here in Worcester, Massachusetts. You can find them at offtherailswooster.com. They have a great restaurant, a great music venue. They have everything you would want to feel like in Nashville right here in Central Mass. If you're ever in the area, check out the restaurant, check out the music venue. Again, offtherailswooster.com, 90 Commercial Street, Worcester. Check them out. Hello, Mr. Terry.
Jim, how are you doing, bud?
Oh, man, I'm doing so good. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Sorry, but forgive my delay here.
No, it's all right, dude. We're getting, we've been getting wet up here in New England, too, the last few days. So I get
Okay, I wasn't sure where you were based out of. Okay, so you got the rain going, too.
Oh, it's awful. Right now, it's actually sleeting and hailing, and I can hear the ice pounding off the windows. It's unbelievable for the first few days of April.
Oh boy. Well, can you hear me all right?
I can hear you great. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, it's perfect.
Awesome. Well, thanks Scott for being here. I gotta tell you, this is like a 28 29 year old Jim is like losing his mind right now.
Say that again?
I said 28, 29-year-old version of me is losing his mind right now talking to you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks, man.
Yeah, man. You know, we've had a few interactions over the years, and you know, I'm sure you don't remember because I barely remember. But you know, I remember seeing you guys. Oh shit! Years and years ago, making your way through like at places like TT the Bears and
oh yeah,
you know, the original House of Blues in Cambridge or whatever the hell it was.
That's
at that
right.
Point. You know. Those are great shows, man.
You know what, man? I appreciate you saying that. I always found Boston to be such a tough town for us. We would, you know, I remember TT the Bear as well. And let's see where else. There are places like The Church.
Yeah.
I remember having a, you know, I remember that place. I think, what was it? There's a story. One of the first times we ever came into town, I remember we were in Alston, I think is the neighborhood. And it's now it's a venue. I think it's called Brighton. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the Brighton Music Hall.
Yeah. But before that, it was called, shoot. Oh, it's going to drive me nuts. Well, whatever the name of the place was, we had played there. And I remember walking in the place and it was a great place, but we were running late. And I remember my wife was with us and she was sick. She had just gotten sick. So we were all, you know, a little frazzled, and we pulled up to the front door of the place, and this guy was standing there. He was waving down. He's like, "You guys, the band?" And we said, "Sure. Yeah, we're the band. Sorry, we're a little late." And he said, "That's fine. Here, open the door. I'll show you where to park." And he took us around the back of the venue. And then he starts, you know, unloading equipment with us and saying, "This is the door we go through." And then as he's rolling equipment with us, he's like, "Now, my name," he's like, "you got to put my name on the list. So because I helped you with the parking and I'm helping you with equipment, I drink on your tab tonight." And we were like, "Wait, we don't work for the venue?" And he's like, No. I'm Danny Flynn. Danny Flynn. Put my name on the list." And then we find out that apparently that's like a scam that he had been pulling for quite a while. And the venue was like, "Don't let that guy in." Oh, it was called Harper's Ferry. That was the name of the venue.
That's right.
Harper's Ferry. But I just remember, right away being like, "Man, this is a colorful town. This is a wild place." And got guys, you know, scamming to get on the band's tab so they can drink all night. But we just played City Winery up there, and it's definitely a little more tame at the City Winery than it was in the old days of playing out in, what is it, like in Harvard Square there. What was the name of that place?
I can't remember one? But it was the original House of Blues,
right? Because I remember someone showing us on the sidewalk that what is it, Donald Duck Dunn and some of those guys from the original band?
Yeah.
They all signed their names in the sidewalk.
Yeah, you know, I remember the first time I saw you guys there twice, I want to say. And I want to say it was the first time, you know, you guys got done your set and like it was like a hurry up and like the room was full and it turned into like a nightclub.
Uh-huh.
And it was wild because there was like, you know, you have, you know, people like me that are there to see you guys, and then it's all these, you know, drunk college kids that have no idea what the hell's going on. And it was like the wildest thing. And like everybody that worked in the venue was like, "If you're not here for the club, you gotta go. And like,
you know what? It's true. That was those days of playing the small clubs on the East Coast. It wasn't just Boston. I remember feeling that in a few cities where, you know, you play your show and it's like they just turn and burn the room so fast.
Yeah.
They like, whether it be, you know, there's a late show with another band or there's a, you know, usually it was always sort of like the room suddenly turned into, because they were trying to keep the people that were there for like, you know, dance night or something like that. You know, a DJ would be on in 5 minutes after we're done playing, and it's, you know, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's funny because I also remember one of the first times I saw Matt Nathanson, it was the same kind of thing. He had played at like a club slash concert venue.
Oh yeah.
Down in the theater district in Boston, and the show was early, and we were all kind of like, "That's weird. It's a weird start time for a Saturday night." Mm-hmm. And the second Matt went off stage, like they made an announcement. It was like, "All right, you gotta go, and you gotta go now." And it was just wild. It's wild that they do that.
Wow. Well, you know, yeah, I've known Matt for a long, long time. I met Matt down at NACA Nationals doing the college thing, and I remember our band playing. I was so impressed with him. He was standing on a stage all by himself. You know, at the time, I remember him covering Bon Jovi, "Living on a Prayer," and he had the whole place singing. And I thought that was pretty remarkable. I got to tell you, I was going to let you know that Boston hasn't changed much.
No.
I also wanted you to, what's the name? The Middle East.
Yeah.
We played the Middle East a couple of years ago, and I had broken my arm. And I remember playing there. It was the first show that I played. The day before I had surgery on my arm because I broke it in DC while we were on tour. But I was able, so I missed the show in Connecticut, but we played Boston. And I remember as soon as the show was done, there were fire alarms and things going off. The entire street flooded, all the bars flooded out into the street. It was like mayhem. And I remember thinking like, wow, this town, a wild place. And while City Winery was not nearly as wild as that, when we pulled in the parking facility, the area for City Winery just a few weeks ago, there was a taxi cab that was in the spot. Like there was, you know, we have a bus and a trailer, so it's like 65 feet. And this one vehicle was sitting in the way. And we had asked them, you know, we were first, no one was there. Then the cabbie came back and he was so upset that because I guess apparently it's a taxi stand. But City Winery pays for it when there's large venues that come or large vehicles that come through.
Sure.
So the next thing you know, we couldn't park. We're sitting there double parked out in the street causing traffic because this cabbie is getting, you know, puffing up his chest and fighting with the management at City Winery. And it was like, we were just there. We're like, man, this town, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's always something. There's always something going on.
You know, it really is. It really is. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, there's such a charm to it, and it's also crazy at the same time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, I kind of, you know, I think back, and I've been thinking about this conversation for probably years at this point.
Wow.
And I remember when I stumbled across Red, Wanting Blue for the first time. You know, however you want to see it, a huge OAR fan. And
nice.
You know, back in the days when, you know, before Facebook before Facebook really became a thing and all that, you know, OAR had a fan website
mm-hmm.
thing, and somebody had posted about, These Magnificent Miles. And
no, they did. Nice.
I was like, huh, I want to check this out. And that is where my love affair with Red, Wanting Blue started.
Oh, wow. That was a good one. I love that record.
Yes. You know, and then the way you guys, you know, and the way the documentary came out and all that, like, can you, if you don't mind, can you kind of walk me through those early days of, you know, when you guys started or when you started and...
Sure.
You know, how, you know, up until that point, what was going on?
Well, I mean, you know, to give you the real quick version, you know, I started the band at Ohio University in Athens, where I went to school. I was in and out of there in 4 years, and it's a very, very charming, wonderful town. And it was a great incubator for creating a band. But it's a town that's 100 miles from anywhere. And it seemed even right away when I started the band, probably sophomore year in college, we began just, you know, driving up every week up into Columbus to play shows. And Columbus seemed to be the big spot. That was where the two major highways in the state met, was right in the center of the state. So we knew we were going to be graduating and moving up to Columbus. And by the time I graduated with a theater degree, and by the time I had graduated, I felt like I was further ahead with music than I was with doing any theater and performance. So I just wanted to stick with it. And at that point, there were some guys in the very, very beginning that, you know, back then there weren't a lot of auditions happening. You know, it was sort of, hey, you have drums? Great. Well, you can be a drummer. You got a bass? Well, then great. You can be my bass player. You know, we'll be in a band. And so moving up to Columbus was sort of like, I think I want to do this for real. And two of the guys didn't make it. My guitar player and I found two other guys that we had known that we kind of over the years playing other shows with during school. And we just started cracking at it, playing all around, you know, concentric circuiting. And it pretty much went that way for the next 10 years from about 2000 to 2010. And we found ourselves playing at 150 or so odd shows a year. And never stopped. We never stopped. We would write music along the way on the road and, you know, found ourselves making, you know, stopping for short breaks, little spits, making records. And that we made three records in Columbus at a studio that we still care a lot about, with an engineer that we care a lot about, and even use them on this newest record. But we wound up around sort of around the time where the documentary stuff was starting to happen, which was a whole other story. That was an interesting thing that wound up coming our way. My wife, who I chased for, you know, I'm trying to say 2000 was when we started seeing each other, and she lived in New York. She was an actress and in the entertainment world. So I was always chasing her, and through a friend, she had someone that she worked with who approached us about making the documentary and followed us around for a couple of years. I want to say maybe a year and a half, 2 years, because he loved the music and wanted to, you know, create a story. And he was hoping in his own mind that this was going to be some big thing catching on Netflix and, you know, telling the story of this band. But, you know, there wasn't really a villain in the story. It was more of a, you know, this is what a bunch of guys, you know, this is what a band trying to go out in the world with no real, you know, tricks up our sleeve as far as having a celebrity parent or, you know, someone who's coming from, you know, large sums of money. You know, we're just regular kids trying to follow a dream. And, you know, I'm sure he probably got exhausted at the effort, and he wound up kind of wrapping it up and sort of making it, it almost seemed like it was more for our fans by the end. But, you know, that was a moment. But during that time, right after that, because I remember thinking, wow, like nothing really happened. We thought we would do this documentary and something was going to come from it. And shortly thereafter, we wound up getting approached by a label out of New York, Fanatic, and met one man in particular who really helped with, he was a real champion for our band. His name was Josh Bloom. He ran Fanatic Promotions. He was a PR firm for a lot of really cool indie groups in New York. And he started a record label. He cared about us very much. And he was a big soldier for pushing us forward and working for us. And I think that's why from the vanishing point, a lot of his sweat equity went into getting us onto, you know, like doing David Letterman and getting, having the good fortune that kind of came our way at that moment. Yeah. So we owe a lot to him. We made three records with Fanatic, and then, and those three records, including the one that you like, These Magnificent Miles, we found a, we were working with a producer named Jamie Candeloro, and we had met him through an entertainment firm that was representing us at the time out of New York. And he had, we had been recommended Jamie by Josh Greer, and he was managing Ryan Adams at the time. And he was sort of the music supervisor for this entertainment firm. And we met up with him, and he said, I think you should meet with Jamie, because Jamie had just produced Easy Tiger.
With keeping that Central Mass vibe going, we have to thank our friends over at the DCU Center, again, here in Worcester, dcucenter.com. They are the premier venue here in Central Massachusetts. They are a mid-size arena. They're the home of the Worcester Railers, the Massachusetts Pirates, numerous concerts, numerous events. Check them out, dcucenter.com. They are at 50 Foster Street, right here in Worcester. Cheers.
So yeah, we kind of hit it off with him, and we wound up making three records with him. And then we thought that that was kind of a good ending to that, you know, those three albums with Fanatic. And before you know it, we were making a record, the last record, The Wanting, with a very close friend of ours who we toured the country with a number of times. And known for years, named Will Hoag, who's a Nashville guy. And Will had, you know, after many talks, and actually, again, like, I owe it to my wife and to Will's wife, Julia. They were on a beach in Mexico when they brought up the question to us and said, you know, you guys should make a record together. Will, why don't you produce a record with Red, Wanting, Blue? Red, Wanting, Blue, you guys should work with Will. And we'd known each other for a long time. And he, you know, after we pondered it, you know, we thought, let's try it. So we'd never made a record in Nashville up to that point. So Will brought us down to Nashville. We recorded at Sound Emporium, which was a real treat, you know, getting to record in a studio that's as well, you know, decorated and artists that have recorded there. It was a personal, you know, treat for me, you know, sitting in the same sound booth that Michael Stipe recorded Document, and, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a room that had a lot of mojo, and it was a fun experience, and we really enjoyed making that record. And we learned a lot. We learned a lot from that. Toured on it pretty much right up until it was Pandemic City.
Yeah.
You know? And so this newest record that's coming out in June, Light It Up, I'm probably most proud of all the records we've ever made, because this one we actually produced ourselves, kind of taking all the 2+ decades of all of the knowledge that we've learned from people we admire and people we've worked with, and wound up creating a record that I think far and away is our best work. And I know that might sound strange for someone who's been doing it as long as I have, but I really do think so. And I think that our label, Blue Elan, who kind of jumped on a moving train, and I give them a lot of credit, Blue Elan, they're based out of Los Angeles. They jumped on board when we had The Wanting. It was already made, and we were going to just potentially release it ourselves. But they approached us and were like, hey, let's do it. So they wound up releasing The Wanting. And this process has been better with this new one, Light It Up, because they've been a part of the process from the very beginning. So, you know, we're grateful for that. And Light It Up was a record that, you know, started pretty much from around 2020. And we wound up scrapping a number of things as the world kind of went on its side, and things had we had new perspectives on certain things, and found ourselves, I think, probably around late 2021 and into 2022, just going back to the drawing board on a number of things. because we had a different idea of what we really wanted.
Hmm.
And then, because after the world goes through something like that, and you're sitting around for almost, you know, for a year and a half, listening to all of these people releasing, you know, acoustic records, isolationist records, you know, sad and somber, introspective records. And we were writing some of those same things ourselves. It just became clear the further and further we were, like, as we saw the light at the end of the tunnel and the world was kind of getting itself out of the hole it was in, it just became clear, like, I don't know that I want to sing these things. I don't know that we want to remember it this way.
Right.
Maybe there will be a time where you want to go back to some of those songs, but, you know, and I could be wrong about that. That's just my opinion. But I felt like, you know, no one's going to want to sit around going to a live show. We're a live band. That's what we're good at, Jim.
Yeah.
That's what we've done. You know, we've cut our teeth and been doing it for a long time. And I don't know a lot of live bands that want to, like, stop and sing somber songs.
Right.
Because,
right,
you know, there's a time and place for those. But, excuse me. Sorry. No, but there's a time and place for those songs. But it just got us thinking, man, when we get out of this, if we can get out of this, people are going to want energy, and they're going to want color, and they're going to want, you know, they're going to want life and right. movement, and then what people are going to want to be outside. So we kind of focused on that. And it wasn't a concept record and didn't start out that way, but I think by the end of it, it sort of feels like it did. It became one. And we were very, very lucky through a simple twist of fate and an old drummer from our band, Mark Stepper, who played with us back in the Pride the Cold Lover era. We reconnected, and he actually brought up using the guy who wound up mixing our record, John Spiker, because he's a Columbus, Ohio native. And we brushed shoulders early on in both of our careers, but he's since moved to Los Angeles, and he's an awesome, awesome mixer. The band couldn't have been happier with the way it had turned out. And I feel like, you know, Jim, I've said this before in other interviews, but I'm telling you that, like, I feel like bands are a lot like golf. There are people who are, they've got a good long game, but they've got a terrible short game.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and, or vice versa. And I feel like bands are like that with albums. There's, you're like, you know, they'll be like, they're a really great live band. Their records are all right, but they're not, you know, they're not as, you know, but I love, yeah. You got to see the band live. You got to see them live. And then there's those bands that you can say, man, this is one of my favorite albums. I can play this forever. I love it. I adore it so much. And then you go see the band, and then you go, they don't really live up to the record. You know,
that is so true.
It's a hard thing to try to find balance in that. And that's why we wanted to produce our own record this time, because Will Hoag is certainly the closest. He threw the dart closest to the bullseye on the board, but we felt like we could get closer. And as we've gotten older and gotten better at, you know, creating song beds and being able to use the music as a pen to create, you know, our own voice and signature and make something, you know, when we, you know, I think that we were like, we just knew we were ready to do it that way. And John Spiker just absolutely crushed it. He knocked it out of the park, and, you know, he found the voice that we were looking to get out there. And I couldn't be prouder of the way it sounds.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because it's like, I'm listening to you tell, you know, the story of everything. And, you know, I think about, you know, the way I, you know, as a fan, right, as the way I have seen your music and, you know, the progression over, you know, since I've gotten into it, You know, it's very interesting, you know, because I, for me, if you don't mind me saying, right?
Yeah.
I see, like, these Magnificent Miles from The Vanishing Point and Little America almost like an extension of each other. You know, like, you could play, to me, right? You could start these Magnificent Miles and play it right through to the end of Little America. And you know what you're getting, right? You know, the storytelling is there. The solidness of the band is there. Like, it's, to me, it's three of probably the most underrated albums in music in the last 20 years. And I'm not just saying that because you're on the phone. I tell that to everybody. You know,
well, geez, Jim, thanks.
And no, you're welcome. You know, and it's, you know, there's some of my favorites, you know, and honest to God, you know, you talk about, you know, these are records that I could literally put on and listen to for the rest of my life.
Wow.
You know, and then
that means a lot.
Oh, of course. You know, and then, you know, there becomes a shift, you know, and I wanted to kind of ask you about that. You know, when The Wanting comes out, I mean, the storytelling's there, you know, you've always had the storytelling, Scott. You're probably one of the best storytellers in music. But you know, the sound of the band starts to change a little bit, you know, in The Wanting record. Yeah. And then, you know, it's changed now even more with Light It Up. Like, that, you know, how do you go from a very similar recognizable sound for three records to, you know, kind of shift?
Well, no, that's a great question. I think that we sort of had those sounds came, those earlier records. I've always considered myself to be an autobiographical writer, and the band is autobiographical in the sense that we try to write about what is going on around us in our lives. And what people don't maybe know or see is that when These Magnificent Miles was recorded, Eric, our guitar player, had only joined the band a couple months earlier. So he was coming in almost like a hired gun. And he had been recommended by our previous guitar player. Eric and John John was our, like, an interim guitar player. And they had grown up together. And we knew John wasn't going to be in it for, you know, the long haul. But when you're a young indie band and you're doing it yourself, you know, you're like sharks, you know, you have to, if you stop moving, you die.
Right.
So you had to keep dates on the schedule. You had to keep people playing. So if somebody wasn't able to go, you would find someone to jump in, you know, for however long we can keep you until we figure out what we're doing. And Eric had joined the band not that long, just a few months before we were recording. And those songs that were being written at that point in time, it was primarily myself and Mark, our bass player. And I had fortunately, and I feel like out of necessity, really, really started opening up as a songwriter and really taking ownership of that department. And shortly thereafter, our drummer, who is also an interim drummer, his name was Eddie Davis. He's on the documentary. He also left the band, and shortly thereafter, I want to say a year plus after that. So Dean Anschutz, who's our drummer, he joined the band, I think, right around the beginning of 2010. And so from 2008, Eric joining the band, and then 2010, Dean joining the band. And we were touring 150 shows a year. So these guys were getting inundated with a lot of how the band has written previous, but it was all new to them. Right. And then we were touring so much and then moving to the next record, like, almost, you know, that was about all we ever took time for, was, you know, carve out a couple weeks to go into a studio somewhere to knock out another, these songs that have been written while on the road. And, you know, we didn't spend a lot of time, you know, we thought we were, but we didn't spend a lot of time actually trying to make the sounds that we wanted. You know, we just kept thinking it'll be like a moment in time. You know, we're capturing a moment in time of these are these new songs that we hope to be playing out live at the places that we play. And we have just enough time to hopefully record them all. And our producer will hopefully mix them nicely and hopefully people like them. And that was kind of where, that's how it was. And those guys, I think, as, you know, slowly but surely started to get, you know, they were starting to figure out how to use their own voices in the band. And as they, as those albums kind of went, I mean, I think about those years and they all blur together so fast because we were playing so much. We were on the road a lot. And, you know, when we were off alone, you know, I would privately write songs and because that's how all I knew how to do. And then I would show them to the band. We would assemble, a version of it, and we would sort of hammer it out while playing live. But there wasn't a lot of, you know, getting music and being a bit more introspective about it, taking, you know, song beds that someone might send to me, getting me to start thinking outside of my own, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, my own safe places yeah. that I would write in, you know, you can, I know that if I'm not paying attention, I'll be writing a song and it'll be somewhere between 80 and 90 BPM. It'll most likely have, you know, I'll be in one or two keys that I really enjoy singing in. And, you know, the chords will be roughly, you know, the same few chords. And that's, I think a lot of people like to write where they're comfortable. And that's fine. That's great. But much like working on a really good crossword puzzle, which is something I do enjoy doing. I like puzzles. I enjoy being put into a headspace where I wouldn't have thought of that. And I think that that's where you ultimately get great, fresh ideas. When someone else on a drummer is putting together a musical song bed, he's thinking in a BPM, he's thinking in a drum rhythm that I would never think of, because I'm thinking of strumming patterns and what, you know, how I would write it. So as those guys started getting better at seeing how the band worked and the way Mark would deliver song beds to me and music ideas, the other guys started kind of following suit, and again, just getting better and better at their own voice and working together too. You know, Mark would have something and he used to just send it straight to me. He'd then send it to me and then he would send it to Dean without drums and say, Dean, would you, you know, why don't you try to, what would you come up with? And, you know, Eric, what would you do on guitar? And we started working in that realm where, you know, you would say, this is my idea, but I'm also going to take out, you know, your part, so that you can establish, you know, put your own creative thought onto it, and we'll see where we come, you know, see where it ends up. And by doing that, there's a lot of songs that I, on these last two records, that I frankly would have never come from me alone.
Right.
And I think that that's ultimately what it is, what it means to be in a band, when you can actually, you know, I love doing what I do, and I can continue to keep doing what it is that I do. I like being challenged, and I also like, you know, being met with, you know, great, great musicianship and great collaborators, and, you know, getting to hear my voice in a different way and getting to hear our stories being told in a different way. It's like the most exciting thing for me. So that's why I feel like, you know, no one wants to make the same record twice.
Right.
You know, you tell a story and you don't want that to be, you don't want to just have a repeat, you know, you want to try to grow and create something more than what you just, you know, what you did previously. And, you know, so for myself, you know, while I love those records, I also feel like that was at a time where, the storms were coming and I was the only one who had an umbrella. So everyone stood under my umbrella.
Yeah.
You know, and as we, you know, as the records grew on and people got more and more comfortable and we became more and more of a band. Yeah, because you think about that. That record came out, or These Magnificent Miles was first made in 2008, and then it was re-released by Fanatic in 2010. So it was the first music that Eric had ever learned how to play with Red, White, and Blue. And then, strangely, that same music, Dean had...
So I think I would be totally remiss if I didn't mention our friends over at 10thWhiskey.com. That's 10th Mountain Whiskey and Spirit Company. They're out of Vail, Colorado. Great, great friends of ours. We don't like bourbon here at the Boots and Whiskey Podcast, and they make the absolute best bourbon I've ever tasted in my entire life. And I'm not saying that because they've been great to us. They have the best bourbon, the best rye I've ever tasted in my entire life. So check them out, 10thWhiskey.com. Tell them the Boots and Whiskey Podcast sent you. Cheers.
I had to learn how to play. It was, you know, because we wound up touring on it again, but under Fanatic.
Right.
And then we all wrote those, all the next records, you know, together. And I'm grateful for what they've been able to contribute as we've all gotten older, you know, because I feel like the wanting is, I absolutely love where that took my head and took my writing, and the same goes for Light It Up, even further, you know, and it's a nice thing to have your peers, people that you've known for years, other musicians, listen to it and they're coming back to us with, you know, really, really wonderful comments. And, you know, quite a few saying, I think this might be your best work, which is really, really great to hear.
Yeah. That's always going to be nice, you know, especially when you've been doing it, you know, and you, when you get to a point where, you know, I love the way you're talking about this, where it's like, you know, you put the time in and you put the effort in to really make it, you know, an art, you know, not that it wasn't before, you know, but sure, being able to, like, you know, sit with it and actually do it in a way that you would never maybe have done before, you know, it's that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and this record, I think the reason why Light It Up is so different. And it's not, you know, I mean, we took more time with it. And that was intentional. You know, we've been fortunate enough to be a part of this music festival called the Rock Boat,
mm-hmm.
and we've been on it. We've been lucky enough to be on it most of the years of the last decade. And a few years back, we were on with the band Tonic, and the singer for that band, Emerson Hart. Emerson had a he imparted when we were talking, because I was with him and with Will Hoag, who produced our record, the last record, The Wanting. So we were talking about making records, and he had said that he had had a similar experience with us, where he felt like he never had had time to sit with something. It was always sort of like, get into the studio, we're rushing to make this happen. And, you know, after everything's said and done and the dust settles, you kind of try to take stock of the album and you say, okay, you know, like, that song came out better than I thought.
Mm.
This one didn't, I don't think that was realized. I think, like, we kind of missed the mark on this. And, you know, you have to sort of weigh if it, if they worked or not, or how they could have been better. And then you'll never not hear that as you live and move forward and you hear the song, you'll always think of that, like, oh yeah, yeah, we probably could have done that differently, or we should have, you know, like 2 weeks after we did it, I remember hating the way we did it. And then, you know, you have these thoughts in your head. So, but Emerson's advice was to take a song or two a month or however, in whatever frequency we were hitting into the studio, he would say, just take one or two songs and just give yourselves that to focus on. Let that be your homework and just pour all the love into just those two songs or one song, whatever it may be, and like sit with it, because it will undoubtedly inform the next song that you record the next month when you go in to record the next one or two songs. And you'd be amazed at the way you can shape it. And we decided to take that approach to making the record. And I think, knowing how we did it now, I don't know that I'd ever want to do it another way.
Yeah.
Because we've done it the Fast and Furious way before many, many times. And getting to sort of live with something so that, you know, you can look around the room and everybody's like, yeah, this is great. Or what didn't work and let's fix it, you know. And maybe a song that you would have recorded differently had you only given yourself a couple days in between this song to this song. You know, if you gave yourself 2 months to be able to stop and think about it, and you know, the shape will ultimately like change,
right?
And hopefully for the better, hopefully so that you can better articulate the point you were going after, you know, making it, you know, the vision that you had.
Yeah, you know, it's damn, you know, I'm sitting here listening to D. Scott, and like, I knew, you know, based on other interviews I've heard with you, you know, I knew that I was going to get, you know, probably the most informative and honest conversation about, you know, all of these things that we've talked about. And this has been incredible. Like, I am like I am enthralled. You should see, I'm just sitting here, like, with my, you know, my mouth open, and I'm like, wow. Like,
yeah.
You know, because we don't get a lot of the technical aspects of things.
Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, I feel like that's all I'm talking about.
No, it's
stuff. I mean, I can tell you plenty of other non-technical things.
It's awesome.
But,
you know, with that sense and that sort of thing, I do have, you know, like I said, I've said it a million times, and I'm sure everybody listening to this is sick of me saying it, but, you know, I've been a huge fan for, you know, the last decade plus, right? I have a few things I've always wanted to know.
Fire away.
So I'm going to fire away. Okay. The first is, I remember seeing you and you always had, I don't know what it was. It was like a beverage of some sort and it was red. What the hell is that?
Yeah. Well, if it's been a decade plus, I used to drink a lot when I was younger, and it became like a, you know, an occupational hazard. Yeah, I think sure. there's a lot of I'm sure you've heard about it on Boots and Whiskey podcast. Oh, yeah. You know, but you know, in the younger and wilder days, I think it became an issue for me where I felt, you know, I'll quote my wife, you know, where it just felt like no more good was going to come my way without some form of a sacrifice. And I quit drinking for a number of years. And during that time, I was desperate to find something that would be, you know, I could latch onto, like a thing, a show drink or something that would just be mine.
Sure.
And I drank through a lot of non-alcoholic beer that didn't taste very good. We're living in a beautiful time now. There's so much great, you know, non-alcoholic stuff out there and so many great options for people. But back then there was not. And I tried de-alcoholized wine and it was not good. And it was just, I kept beating it around. And at one point I was out somewhere and they had this Italian drink. And this woman said, oh, it tastes terrible. It tastes like it's got alcohol in it. But it doesn't. And I said, really? Well, let me try that. So, and it was made by San Pellegrino. It was called San Bitter. And I absolutely fell in love with it because it made me think I was drinking, but I wasn't drinking. Okay. So I used to buy this stuff by the pallet from this Italian grocery many, many years ago. And I'd go on tour and leave because these bottles are like 3.5 ounces. They're so small. And I would dump two of them and I would drink this red stuff and leave these little glass bottles everywhere I went. And it was, yeah. So that was for a number of years. And one day they showed up and said, I went to the place to get it. And they said, can't get it anymore. The U.S. put it on some watch list. So I was like, oh my God. So I had to make other arrangements, you know, and shortly at that point, it was, you know, many, many years had gone by and I just had to sort of move away from San Bitter. You can still get San Bitter now. If you go to Italian grocery stores, they you can find it floating about, but yeah, I've moved on and I found myself getting, drinking a concoction that's of it's a, my own little special thing that I have, and I usually drink it in a red flask people now know me for on stage, and you know, that's my little special drink. It's a little secret. If you get to know each other better, you know, I'll let you try it.
sounds like a plan.
Yeah.
Now, I can't tell you how many people I've introduced Red, One, and Blue to, right? And brought them to live shows and, you know, people that have never heard you or the band or anything. And it's like, you get on stage and within the first notes, your singing voice does not match your face at all. How do you find such a powerful, charming, almost soothing sound to your voice when you would, you know, kind of expect like a different sound, not a bad sound, but like something different, not maybe as powerful or, you know, like you could stop a room.
Oh man, well, that's very, very sweet of you to say. I've been very lucky. I've been singing my whole life. And when I was a kid, I sang in a bunch of choirs and I learned a lot. I learned a lot of about singing that I didn't actually want to follow the rules to. You know, I learned how to sing the right way. And I remember being in high school and then starting the band in college. And all I wanted to do was unlearn all this stuff that I had learned because I wanted to sing my way and find my voice. And, you know, as I was trying to become, you know, as a young songwriter. And I think that there's, you know, I've been lucky enough to not, because I know how to use my voice properly for me, and everybody's a little different. Everyone's a little different. I think that I beat it up enough and I screwed it up enough in just the right kind of ways, you know, that, and played so many shows over the years that I, you know, whether or not it's, you know, I'm glad that you like it because I can't do everything with it. It's, you know, I think it's pretty versatile.
Yeah.
But it's, but there's still stuff that I wish I could do better. I wish I could sing falsetto better and other stuff. But I, you know, I think ultimately you get the voice that you deserve. And with, after all the years, and you know, but I was always, as a kid, fascinated by soul singers, by, you know, I always loved the songwriting of folks like, you know, Paul Simon and, you know, but they were very soft singers.
Right.
And so while I loved the lyrical stories that they, you know, someone like Paul Simon would tell, I was drawn to listening to, you know, like Van Morrison, Moondance as a kid, and just wanting to, you know, belt. And I felt like that was, you know, listening to Otis Redding and, conveying emotion that way. And how do you do that? And, So, and I had a lot of time to practice over the last 20 some years. And some bars where people were listening and some, and others where they weren't.
Yeah. You know? Now, with that, with your voice and the way you, you know, in your style and all that, you know, we've seen, you know, in the music world, right?
Yeah.
Where you'll have a band.
Hey, everyone. As always, I wanted to just tell you about our friends over at The Bar Book. The Bar Book is a mobile app designed to eliminate the guesswork when looking for a great drink and introduce users to new brands that have the flavors they love, regardless of price or name recognition. How badass is that, guys? In the same way music sharing apps introduce you to new songs, the Bar Book will give you personalized drink recommendations based on the flavors you love. That's freaking cool. The Bar Book is a veteran-owned brand founded by two U.S. Army veterans, Mike and Dolly, and they have a lot going on with this cool new app, guys. Check it out. We had Mike on the show not too long ago. You can check them out at thebarbook.co. You can follow them on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, all at The Bar Book. Rate your favorite beer, spirits, cocktails, and discover new ones that match your flavor profile all on The Bar Book. Go download it. Love having these guys as friends. Check it out. Thanks, guys. Cheers.
And even when the band's going well and things are fine, you know, you'll see a front and, you know, do something on the side, or, you know, do a little tour on their own, right? You know, we saw that with OAR, you know, Mark goes out on his own and all that.
Sure.
Why haven't we seen a Scott Terry solo kind of thing?
Well, we haven't seen one yet.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Well, you know, I think, you know, again, it's these things, for so many years, I felt like you have to take things when they feel natural. I don't think you don't want to push things when they're not needed. I feel like when I was younger, this band is not just a band, but it's a family, it's a religion, it's a community, it's everything to me. And I had to be present for it at all times. And for many years, my wife and I have been together for 24 years now. And the first 10, 11 of those years, I still had a place in Ohio because I was worried about, you know, we split it long distance and traveled back and forth all the time with one another because I felt like I couldn't separate and be away from the band for that long. And fortunately, as we get older and the band, you know, stabilized and got into a place where I think we all felt like it was, you know, we no longer had to keep it, you know, trying to keep the ball in the air. That it was, this is a band. These guys aren't going anywhere. None of us are going anywhere. The touring stabilized in a different kind of way. And become a huge part of our identities at this point. It felt there was a time where it was like, I think, you know, I'm going to make the jump and I'm going to go move to New York and my wife and I are going to live out there. And it makes for a lot of driving at times and a lot of extra travel. But I think that that was a moment where it gave everyone was given that permission to like, hey, we, as long as we can all come together and find a way to make this work, you know, we'll do that.
Yeah.
And we've been able to make that happen. And then over the last however many years, you know, I've written songs. Some songs don't make their way onto Red, One, and Blue Records, but I've released them when I'm doing like a songwriter's circle or something, and shows up on YouTube. And, you know, I think about those a lot, and I'm sure, you know, like it's my hope to have, you know, some music that, you know, would just be Scott music that'll be out for folks. Yeah, at some point. And, you know, the other guys, the same thing. You know, I mean, during the pandemic, Mark released himself, you know, he released some songs on a record, and Eric and Dean have had side projects that they've done. And, you know, because I think you get to a place where you're, you know, when you're young, I think it's like, oh my, you know, like everyone's acting like a, you know, a jealous girlfriend and everyone's cheating on each other. You can't do that, you know. And I think as you get older, you get a little more comfortable with that. And one thing at a time, you know. Also, you know, years ago, the thought of someone getting married would have been unheard of. And then it was like, oh, one of us got married, and now most of us are married.
Right.
And, you know, and then before you know it, somebody has a kid, and now there's two kids in the band, you know. So,
right.
So it's just with time and age and not rushing it. And, you know, I think that, I think as we're figuring out, you know, what the next chapter will be for the band, you know, those things will become clearer. But I'm very excited for, you know, where we're at this moment, you know, because I feel like we're lucky enough to still, because we started the band so young, that to be at the age that we're at, you know, and I'm the oldest. Mark and I are the oldest guys in the band. You know, Dean's the baby in the band, and Dean's 10 years younger than me.
Yeah.
You know, so, but we're young. So I at least, and we feel young. And we've still got plenty, you know, plenty of tread left on the tire.
Yeah.
So we plan on using it and burning it up.
Good.
Which is incidentally funny. I wanted to let you know, Jim, too, that, you know, you're saying you like these Magnificent Miles so much. I remember going to the record label and telling them, this is what I want to call this record. And they were like, is it a greatest hits? And I said, no. And they're like, are you quitting after this? And I said, no. And they're like, oh, that's a terrible title. I think it's a terrible title. It's just sounds like you're about to quit.
Oh boy.
And I was like, really? Oh, and we went with it anyway.
Right.
Fortunately, that clearly didn't happen.
Right. Right. No. But, all right. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to put your feet to the fire, I think, maybe. Now,
okay.
I have read interviews. I have listened to interviews. I have seen interviews. And every now and again, somebody will bring up where Red, One, and Blue, the name, came from.
Yeah.
Now, in all of the explanations I have heard.
Yeah.
I don't know if I buy it.
Really?
I don't know. Like, there's parts of it where it's like, huh. And then, you know, like, I don't feel like I've ever gotten a full story out of it, if that makes sense. All right.
Well, okay. Well, I mean, the full story, I mean, I guess, again, when I was young and in college, and the band was just starting, we didn't have a name, but we were getting together. It was basically my guitar player and I. And we had one other guy, we had a drummer. And at that time, I was doing a lot of this like free flow writing. I felt like I had just, you know, it was my first year away from my family. I'm finally like in college. I'm a free man, and I'm, you know, I just had so much to say and write down. And so I wrote songs, but I wrote a lot of poems and a lot of poetry too, and a lot of just dribble, you know, just like stuff that I would, and then I would pick from and pull from lines and things that I thought I liked. One of the lines was, far too often we've been finding ourselves riding red, wanting blue. And I loved it because it was a play on Red Riding Hood. I was like, huh. writing Red Wanting Blue. And this was at a time where like bands like Toad the Wet Sprocket were like, you know, I was sucking the bone marrow out of those records in the 90s. And Grant Lee Buffalo and these, you know, long named groups. And I thought, right, I got the name of the band. It's Riding Red, Wanting Blue. And the guys were like, that name is terrible. It's such a long name. And I'm like, come on. So what? It's cool, man. It's like, you know, playing off of, you know, Red Riding Hood, like Riding Red, Wanting Blue. And they were like, it sounds terrible. And then at one point, somebody was like, I could tolerate if we just cut off the riding part. And I was like, that's like the best part. I was like, no. And it was like, you know, but they were, it was ultimately like, well, what if it's just Red Wanting Blue? If it's Red Wanting Blue, that sounds, that just sounds better. And then even as we did it, we were worried for the first, at least the first year, that maybe we should change the name because it felt like everybody kept saying Red, White, and Blue. So you say, no, it's Red Wanting Blue. And they say Red, White, and Blue, or Red Wine and Blue. Red Wine and Blue. And it was amazing how so many people could get the name wrong. but, you know, what I liked about it, and still going back to the very, you know, silly driveled writing that I wrote, was I liked that they were primary colors, that one cannot be the other.
Yeah.
That it was a playing off of like these two things that are absolute and one cannot be the other. And it is very much the human condition to try anyway, like alchemy, like trying to turn lead to gold, trying to like make this one thing something that it can't be. But we try anyway. And there's so many parallels that one could take to kids with a pipe dream trying to be in a rock and roll band. It's sort of a defeatist, like, it's not going to work because it can't work because it's not supposed to work. And we know it. It's the square peg in the circle hole. Kids with a pipe dream, forget it. You'll never make it. One can't be this other thing. But it seemed like a good mission statement to be like, you know what? But if we keep trying, you know, we'll see. We'll see how far we can get, you know, we'll see how far we can, how, you know, what we can do. And then over the years, I'm sure I've, you know, created better or more flowery versions of an explanation. I know I used to, for years, I used to say the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence is what it means.
And right.
It doesn't really mean that. it doesn't mean that. That's just kind of like a cheap shortcut for me to say,
yeah,
you know, what it really meant was, you know, these things that are not meant to be trying to do it anyway.
Right.
The human condition, what got us to the moon, what gets us to the bottom of the ocean, you know, despite the fact that we cannot breathe underwater, we cannot breathe in outer space, yet we find a way to do it. It's sort of like conjuring the magic to make something like that happen when we know that our limitations are going to deny us from that. We cannot fly, yet we find a way.
Right.
Because we are ingenuitive as a species. We are creative in that. If you have imagination and creativity driving you, you can somehow find workarounds. And that is promising to kids that grow up from, that are not, you know, the children of celebrities or the wealthy. Right. So we're just ordinary kids trying to get their music out.
You know, I think somebody I know said it best once, you know, it really is like this, you know, the dream's a whale, Scott.
Yeah.
You know?
Who quoted it? Yeah, who said that?
I don't know. But I guess that's probably one of my favorite songs of all time.
Thanks, man. That's one of my favorites. It's one of my favorites too. I love playing it. Every night it's become that song's really become the mission statement for our band in a lot of ways, certainly in a live, when we play live. But that's it. That really, it is it.
It is,
you know, and that's yeah, it's. I could handle that. I can handle that connection to red wanting blue too.
Yeah,
saying the dreams away.
Yeah, you know it's been great, you know, for me to see or watch, you know, really watch the last, God, what am I? I'm 37, 20, yeah, 10, 11, 12 years.
Yeah.
Of, you know, seeing you from the, you know, seeing you in those, you know, divey clubs in Boston to, you know, I think I did see the first City Winery show that you came up here and played.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, it was, you know, to see that kind of evolution of you just in this market alone, yeah, has been incredible. And you know, it really is like watching, you know, dreams come true, because it's been.
Oh, that's very sweet to say. You know, there's another great room we found ourselves playing more than once was out in Natick. There's like a performing arts center, yeah, out there that we played.
Yeah, the Narrows Performing Arts Center or something like that.
Yeah, they, you know, again, like the place was so supportive, and like it was such a wonderful experience playing there. We've done it now twice, that I would, you know, it's, again, I keep looking to the, you know, beyond Boston and the surrounding areas and trying to get back out. And, you know, I always felt like we would go, you know, we'd make our way to Boston, you know, get beat up, and then, you know, lick our wounds and head down the coast. And we never really went beyond there. You know, we played Portland a number of times and gotten up to Vermont here and there. But like, you know, yeah, I'm hoping that we can sort of fix that in the future, and that, you know, that we can use Boston as a doorway to that whole neck of the woods, because it's, personally, I absolutely adore it. It's like my favorite places to go geographically. I love it up there so much.
Yeah, it's not too bad, you know. As a native New Englander, I'm ready for warm weather and no potential snow. But that's just me.
Right, this is true.
Well, Scott, I've like I said at the beginning, like this has been a you know, a career moment for me, being able to talk to you and really getting, you know, a sense of you and the music and, you know, where you've come from and where you are now. And it's a huge pleasure having you here.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah. I wanted to ask you something too.
All right, what's up?
What are your favorite boots?
Oh,
what's your favorite whiskey?
Oh, come on. Are you just saying that because you've listened to this before?
No, I haven't.
No? Because that's what I was going to ask you in the long run.
Oh, really?
Yeah. so my boots, I have two pairs. I have a pair of Ariats and I have a pair of Dixons.
Okay.
I like my Dixons because they're a little more dressy. So like if I'm looking to be fancy, that's what I wear.
Gotcha.
But my Ariats, they were my first pair. My wife got them for me for my birthday that in 2020. So I got them 2 weeks before the shutdown.
Okay.
And I didn't wear them for almost a year. So I walk around the house with them, you know, looking like a baby giraffe just out of the womb. And so they've really become my boots of choice.
Nice.
And my whiskey. Oh God. Really anything.
Give me a top three.
Top three. I would say top three. Anything.
Yeah, because I mean I realize it's hard. It's trying to say like favorite movie. It's like, wow, there's so many facets.
You know, I'm a Jack Daniels guy because it's like it's, you know, it's how you, I think it's like what you drink to start drinking whiskey.
Okay.
You know, it's like the Bud Light of beers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Sure.
I like anything that's really coming out of Buffalo Trace. I think that stuff's all really, really good.
Oh, yeah.
There is a distillery in Vail, Colorado called 10th Mountain. Their bourbon is fantastic, and I'm not just saying that because they send us bourbon all the time. But it is very, very good. Yeah. And
well, what's that called again? Tell me the name of that.
10th Mountain.
Okay.
Yeah, they're out of Vail. They're like, they have vodka, they have
Now we gotta thank our friends on the North Shore, the Porch Southern Fair and Juke Joint. Our buddy Jonathan Post is the head chef and owner of The Porch. They are at 175 Rivers Edge Drive, right in Medford, Massachusetts. Don't want to miss this place. They have some of the best food in the region. Jonathan has brought his Nashville roots here to New England with the food, with the hospitality, and most of all, the music. Check them out, theporchsouthern.com.
You know, bourbon, they have a really great rye. I really like rye. I'm a big old fashioned fan.
Okay.
That is my cocktail of choice. Like I'm a 70-year-old man. Those are mine. Well, what about you? I mean, I know you don't drink really anymore, but
you know, when the occasion strikes, I will I will partake here and there in things. I actually kind of moved away from whiskey. I feel like my wife and I got into like a little, when we're celebrating, like Mezcal seems to have really taken us. It's been charming, a charming affair that we've been having. But I wanted you to know that where I live, the next time you come down to this neck of the woods in Brooklyn, I'm right around the corner from the oldest distillery in New York City, where they actually do it all here, and it's called Kings County Distillery, and they've got some pretty great stuff. And then there's another one I think they cheat a little bit, and I think they get the mash from Buffalo Trace. That's what we were told. But another very, very, very good whiskey company called Widow Jane out of Red Hook. They're just down the street too. And they're both, so if you see either Widow Jane or Kings County Distilling, go after them, because they're certainly worth it.
Yeah, I've heard really good things about them, and I've tried reaching out to them actually to like do things and features and whatnot, and I think they were a little hesitant because of laws and
liabilities and whatnot.
I get it. Sure. But yeah,
I will tell you before I forget too, before we get to the boots, I was just going to let you know. So when I was in Kentucky, I went, though I don't really partake in much whiskey anymore, I still hunt for friends and family. And there was a liquor store that wasn't far from the venue that I was going to, like a hardware store, and passed this liquor store, and I went in there, and I found it so interesting because I was like, oh, they've got Blanton's there. There's the Blanton's, and everyone's, chasing after Blanton's. And they had the greatest names. And I don't know if it's just a local thing, and it was in Louisville. I don't know if it was just it's apparently they have a 375 milliliter bottle. So it's like a half bottle. So if you know what Blanton's looks like, it looks like a little cannonball.
Yeah.
And that's what they called it. They called the bottle. They said, how many cannonballs we got back there? And then the half size bottle, they called a hand grenade. Which I thought was hilarious. And then I guess only around Christmas time, they release these little ones that are like, they look like the little airport bottle, but it's like a little, looks like a little Christmas tree ornament. And they said people hang them on their Christmas trees, and they call those cherry bombs. And I just thought it was the cutest thing. This is like local terminology for these bottles that you can only get, because you can only get those two smaller ones inside the state of Kentucky.
That's
just really
awesome.
Outside of that. So
I need to go to Kentucky.
I happen to have them in my house. It's one of one of the pleasures of getting to tour when I and travel around so much. So I'll send you a photo of the three of them together.
Sweet, sweet.
It's pretty cute. But as far as boots, which is a far more important topic.
Yeah.
I think to answer your question, I have two boots that I've been that I love more than all the others, and I have my wife to thank for that. She is the one who pretty much she pushes me where at the time I feel like might be out of my comfort zone, and she always knows what's best. And then so the boots I've been wearing for years now are what are those things called? They're Fry. Fry is the brand.
Okay, yeah.
And they but they're like a kind of a cowboy boot, but they have a zipper on the side because I got busted. She knows I've got these busted old ankles from doing too many stupid things when I was young. So it's got a zipper on the side, but I absolutely love those, and it beats the old like Florsheim shoes that I used to wear. I used to hunt for these types of shoes when I was younger, and they'd always split on the sides, which is why I ultimately stopped wearing them. And there's songs like Walking Shoes, I don't know if you know, where I literally have a line where I say busted boots, and that's pretty much what I'm referring to. I'd wear these shoes until they were all dry rotted, and they would tear out open on the sides. But I have so I would say the shoe that I wear most to play and perform in is this pair of Fries, and my wife also got me a pair of Saint Laurent. They're just a cool looking cowboy boot, sort of meets it's like a vintage cowboy boot. It's really cool, and it's quickly rising to the top of my list too. So again, if I get her approval, that's more than half the battle.
That's right. I think that is the battle, Scott.
if she okays the haircut, if she okays the mustache, if she okays the boots and the clothes, I'm good. I'm happy with it. I can walk on stage a confident man.
I love though how we've been talking, all this time, and then we start talking about boots, and then you hear her from the background making sure you get it right.
That's right. Because she's probably checking to make sure I say the name right. Right. I'm hesitant too. I wish I knew the name. I just know the brand. I just know the brand name. But they're very I'm lucky. Jen, thank you very much for those.
Did you tell him about the Hudson whiskey? Also, that's a good one.
Oh, Hudson is also a good whiskey. Right. That's right. That's what we had at our wedding. We had Hudson. Hudson's another distillery here. I'll tell you what, New York, all of New England with distilling, all the distilleries, they've really come a long way. The other one, actually, Hill Rock. Be on the lookout for Hill Rock. I believe Hill Rock, because you're a rye guy. Hill Rock was, I think, it was made by the same guy from Whistle Pig.
Oh, okay.
So the master distiller from Whistle Pig left and created Hill Rock, and I think he may have passed away. I think he passed away. Yeah, but he made Hill Rock, and they have they've got a couple things like a Solera aged bourbon, and there's a single malt. But we were pointed at. Out by some people who are very, very in the know about whiskey, and they said you won't find a finer made whiskey in the state of New York. Buck stops at Hill Rock, so
I'll have to check that out too.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's good stuff. I love sitting here talking about stuff that's not just band stuff.
Yeah, it's one of those things where. With this show, that's been my goal is to, I don't want to say not talk music, right? Sure. But, you don't ever know how somebody's going to approach it, because, there's some artists out there that's like, they don't want to get personal. They don't want to tell, a life story. They just want to be like, well, this song is about this, and it's like, that's great. There's a place for that. And the way I think we did it at the beginning of this was perfect because it told a story. It wasn't just a, here it is and that's it.
Sure.
But yeah, I've had episodes where I don't even think we've ever discussed music. those are usually the most like crazy ones where it's like topic to topic and have no idea what the hell we even talk about.
I love that. I know. When it's like when you're so like, oh yeah, I got to remind myself to be plugging something or this. You know?
Right. Right.
I only know it because this particular one was set up by Melissa at Blue Alon.
Yeah.
And again, my apologies for being late early on. Flooding in the basement. So
don't.
But I had saw a few talking points, but. Yeah, no, I just I enjoy it very much. I was gonna do one more plug while we're talking about these things that is important to me as my boots is my hat.
I am a big
fan of this hat maker. His name is Travis Kerzee, and it's spelled Kerzee. But he makes custom hats, and he's outfitted not just me, but also some other singers, Tim Warren of Alternate Roots, and John Angus McDonald, the guitar player for the Trues, and the Talbot Brothers are other musicians that we know, and the list goes on. But he's a wonderful hat maker. So if people are out there looking for a one-of-a-kind hat or ever wonder what kind of hat Scott wears, I wear a Kerzee hat, and I would encourage someone to go out and get their own because it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah,
pretty great stuff. I don't know if you're a hat wearer, but
You know, I have a cowboy hat that was sent to me, probably about a year, well over a year ago now. Yeah, and I like it. You know, I really do. I don't know if my head fits it. Well,
right.
But you know, I'm a big like baseball hat kind of guy.
Right.
So that's my kind of go-to. I mean, and gotcha. Even those are hard, you know?
Sure. Oh yeah. I'll tell you what, I wear the hat that I wear because baseball caps don't look good on me.
Okay. That's fair.
I've tried, I have a big head and anything else that can make my head look smaller than it is makes me feel good.
Yeah.
I wish I could wear a good baseball cap. I miss the old days. I miss the old days of being a kid. I used to when I was in high school and middle school, I wore them all the time and I never had an issue with it. But somehow as I matured into manhood, it just doesn't go so well for me.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Like I've always worn them, you know, always, yeah. You know, and I used to be a big fitted hat kind of person and that's all I would wear, and you know, now with the trucker style hats, sure. You know, those fit really well now, and it's like whatever, I'm just gonna stick with it.
Yeah, see, I'm more of a trucker hat guy because they're just bigger.
Yeah,
so I'll be like, oh, I'll wear that trucker hat, you know. And you know,
right,
I would you will sooner see me in a trucker hat than any other type of ball cap.
Yeah, but yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Oh man, Scott, this has been a lot of fun.
I appreciate it, Jim.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And honestly, I can't. The next time you guys are up here, I got to get out to a show again because it's like every time you guys are here, there's something going on, you know. And it's like, come on, guys. Like, can you just come when there's nothing going on in my life, you know?
But we'll work on that.
You know, I'll send you my schedule.
Send us your schedule. We'll try to work around it. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. You know, but it's funny I say that because I used to, you know, going back to my crazy OAR days, you know, I used to legitimately plan my life around shows.
God, those were the days, weren't they? Those were great days.
Yeah. You know, I would wait till, you know, when bands started announcing their concert dates at the beginning of the year. And it was like, I can't plan anything until I know when these bands are coming.
Oh, that's so great.
And it's kind of like a blessing and a curse. You know, like I look back and I'm like, I wasted a lot of fucking time.
You know? Oh, that was, it was well spent. Time right. Well spent.
Right. It sure was.
Well, I think the same. I mean, while I don't schedule it out the same way, because I'm usually, I always miss concerts because I get home from the road and I don't want to go to another music venue.
Right.
I'm like, oh, I don't want to go out anywhere. So I miss certain things. And then when the festivals and the things that I'm lucky enough to be a part of, they've spoiled me to some degree that when I don't want to, you know, like I only know it from by way of being in a band or performing on the event. So, it makes it tougher to make those decisions, mm-hmm. you know, but usually the best stuff always winds up happening when I'm out of town for something else, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like what I do, you know, I haven't had a quote unquote normal concert experience in like 3 years, you know? So it's like, I don't, you know, and I love concerts, you know, so it's like, I don't know how to function for like a regular concert where it's not like a, you know, a quote unquote work thing.
Right. You know,
I don't know what it would be like to just go to a show and not that I don't enjoy it, but just enjoy it. Just sit back and.
Right. It's true. There's moments where you realize you're like, wow, I'm, you know, and I'll go out and see friends play. They'll know that I'm there. They'll ask me to sing a song or there's just, you know, and that's great when I get to do that. But even if you don't, and you're just showing up to watch and support someone or a friend, like it's been a long time since I've just gone to a concert where I don't know that artist. I just wanted to go see that artist and I have no agenda other than to go and enjoy the music. Again, I think these are occupational hazards for guys like us.
Yep. You know, and then, you know, you get reached out to and you're like, they're like, hey, are you around, you know, this weekend? We'd love to have you out. And it's like, not, you know, you sigh where it's like, well, if I say no, then the next time they won't ask, you know?
Right. Sure.
And it's,
yeah. And it isn't it? It's such an it's yeah. What a wonderful thing to be asked. It's like right. Such a. It's a.
Yeah.
Gilded probably, cage. It's a lovely thing to get asked to be a part of.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. Cherish it.
You know. You too. You know. It's a crazy industry. That's for sure.
It's true.
You know.
I'm so glad it's going. It's chugging along.
Yeah.
It's chugging along.
Absolutely. Well, Scott, you know, I've gotten way more time with you than I expected. So I thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, no problem. And I hope the basement dries out soon.
It'll be fine.
That's good.
All instruments are above water. So we're good. Well,
then that's all that matters.
Yeah.
That's all that matters.
Well, wonderful. Thanks for the chat, man. Oh, it's great.
Anytime. It's been a pleasure.
Awesome, man. Well, okay. Well, hopefully, you'll be hearing from us if we get near your neck of the woods.
Sounds good.
All right, brother.
All right, bud.
Well, there you have it, everyone. Our conversation with Scott Terry, the lead singer, frontman. What is the proper term? I mean, both of them are true, right? Lead singer, frontman, one and the same. Anyway, of the Ohio-based band Red, Wanting Blue. If you aren't familiar with their music or, you know, you're just a fan of this show and just listening, do yourself a favor, go check out their shit, man. It's absolutely incredible. Like we talked about in this episode a million times, These Magnificent Miles is, to me, one of the greatest albums in my life. To me, you know, it's real foundation stuff in there for me. And then From the Vanishing Point, and then Little America. If you listen to those three albums back to back to back, like, I don't know. If you've me again, I'm just stumbling over myself because of how excited I was for this episode. But when I listen to those three albums, you know, I can be pretty nitpicky and find something about something I don't like, right? Because that's a great personality trait to have. But those three albums, I can't. There's not a blemish, a hiccup, nothing in those three albums. And they just keep releasing great shit. They got a new album coming out. It's going to be awesome. They're veteran rock boaters. If you've never been on the rock boat, book a ticket. I've never been on the rock boat. I would love to go on the rock boat. I'm a big Sister Hazel guy. Another band I would love to get on here. Ken Block. Shout it out, bud. But yeah, so thank you for tuning in. Again, check us out on all of our socials. Boots and Whiskey Podcast on everything. And then bootsandwhiskeyentertainment.com is the website. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And as you could tell, guys, as always here at the Boots and Whiskey Podcast, it's all about real people, real stories, real country. And you know what? Scott Terry and Red, Wine, and Blue might not be country, but God damn it, the storytelling behind their songs is 150% country music. So you know what? And country music is whatever you want it to be. So thanks for tuning in. Until next week, guys, keep those boots on the ground and the whiskey in the glass. Cheers, y'all. Good night.